It's Reefer Madness, the podcast with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, we're back.
We're back. How's it going?
Good.
So this is the second. This is the second episode of a series of cannabis assisting with opiates.
Yes. Yes. And this one, another cool one that kind of fell in our lap. So we'll do some of the officials off the top. So it's got a really long actual title. Cannabis significantly reduces the use of prescription opioids and improves the quality of life in authorized patient results of a large prospective study. Thankfully, there must have been some marketing people around, and that has been shortened to TOPS. TOPS is the Tilray Observational Patient Study.
Okay.
So we've got one of the lead authors, Philippe Lucas from Tilray. This was a really big study. So 1,145 patients in 21 cannabis clinics across Canada, and they were followed up at 1, 3, and 6 months. So yeah, this is a big group of people that were started on cannabis, and then they asked them a bazillion questions at baseline at 1, 3, and 6 months, and to see how medicinal cannabis affected them, especially how it affected their opioid use, but other stuff too. So this just kind of screamed Reefer Madness all over it. So sent a message to, because we can do that now, just sent a message to, you know, the vice president of Tilray, soon to be Dr. Philippe
PhD
Lucas.
PhD candidate.
And PhD yes. candidate, defending in March. So if you're listening to this after March 2021, hopefully a properly defended and dissertated PhD dude. Mm-hmm. But yeah, really interesting to talk to.
He is. I've looked him up, and he was a Victoria Town Councillor in my hometown, Victoria City Councillor and Regional Director in 2008 to 2011. He wrote a paper, I don't know if you know this, he wrote a paper in 2012 about cannabis as an adjunct to or substitute to opiates. So he's been looking at this for a long time. I wonder if this paper is the precursor to his PhD study.
Well, and that's what it sounds like. Like he refers to it a couple times, and because he's a VP, I only had him for like half an hour, so I had to try not to go down too many rabbit holes. But yeah, he said he's been sort of off and on in the cannabis research thing for 20-ish years, and he's done some masterworks work. He's did some, like you said, actually started a, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but I don't think it was the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club, which you went to, but another similar entity. He's been in the cannabis world for, medicinal cannabis world for 20-ish years.
Yeah, he was the founder of Vancouver Island Compassion Society in 1999.
There you go, that's the one. He's just a very knowledgeable guy. Knows cannabis from the patient side, from the what you want to call it, the promoter, that's not quite the right word, advocate side, and now into the corporate side and the academia side. So I'm not going to find a much more well-rounded interview than Philippe.
Yeah, no, it was a good interview. I researching him and researching his study, one of the offshoots of his study also discovered that cannabis as harm reduction, studies show that patients that use cannabis also drink less alcohol.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's fascinating what cannabis, you know, as we sit and learn, and this is what you and I are doing with this project, Reefer Madness, the podcast. I'm the nurse, Kirk Nyquist.
I'm Trevor Schufeld. I'm the pharmacist. Look, we said it before the interview this time.
Yeah. So one of the things we try to do is we're out and trying to learn about cannabis. And once again, CannaPositive, this is a PhD candidate, a fellow that's been studying cannabis for 20 years. He's credentializing himself as a PhD, an expert of cannabis. And cannabis has a role to play with the opiate crisis that Western society is dealing
North America
with,
for sure, but
Canada.
Yeah, probably farther than that.
Oh gosh, man, European countries, it's the opioid is, I mean, it's killing people along with the pandemic. So again, cannabis, pounding my wood counter here, cannabis has a role to play. This guy's done a study. And again, I get excited when we have these studies. I mean, I know there's lots of lived experience in this program. We talked a lot of lived experience. But when people come out and a large study, and I mean, you must be thrilled by this, a large study, right? It's like a large study has come out and said, look, cannabis can actually be first line.
Yeah, no, and right? Just to... This is a number lover's dream because they collected so much data on these guys. And we only really touch on the opioid part. But, you know, they looked at benzodiazepines, which went down, like SSRIs, which are like antidepressants, went down.
Yeah.
Just so many things when people use cannabis. Now it is only 6 months, and there's always holes you can poke in these things. But, you know, one of its sort of headline numbers is, so we'll get a little nerdy here. So we talk about morphine milligram equivalent. So that's so like 1 milligram of codeine is not the same as 1 milligram of morphine, which is not the same as 1 milligram of hydromorphone. So you can compare them sort of apples to apples. They have us do a little bit of math, so you can say this much codeine equals this much morphine, and it's called morphine milligram equivalents. Don't worry about all the math, but basically if you take the amount of opioids people use, and they measured in morphine milligram equivalents of 152 milligram morphine milligram equivalents at the beginning, they went down to 32.2 at the end. Like, that is a huge drop in the amount of opioids that these people were using over the course of the study. So it's that's a headline in of itself. But like I said, they looked at so many other things. You know, I feel a little sorry for the study participants. They must have been, at each visit must have been an hour long just to collect all the info they're looking for.
But you know, when we want to put this into clinical practice, and neither one of us are prescribers, right? We live with the prescriptions that are given to us and how we educate our clients with them. But I think one of the things I really liked about this study is I think it's got to remind family physicians that 75 to 80% of those people that ended up overdosing on cannabinoids, on opioids, started
with a prescription that came from my pharmacy,
opioids. Yeah. Yes, right? So we as white coat pushers, white coat prescription, you know, medical professionals that are offering people these deadly medications, I think it's incumbent to us to remind prescribers that maybe if they're thinking about using opiates for somebody's acute pain, that they also consider entering them into the medicinal cannabis stream as well. And I think that is something that I pulled out of this study, is that cannabis should now start being a primary frontline medication for acute pain.
Yeah.
Consideration.
No, I agree. You know, neither of us get to write clinical practice guidelines, but if when the pain society gets around to it, I'd like to be bumped up from third or fourth line to first or second line. And Philippe talked about this a little bit. Now, remember, both him and I are biased, so we'll just clear this up front. He works for a company that sells medicinal cannabis. I work in a pharmacy. But it would make a lot of sense if medicinal cannabis went through pharmacies, and it would make a lot of sense if it was covered by drug plans and provincial funding bodies, like in Manitoba, it's called PharmaCare. Because, and they even pulled, because they collected again so much data, they even pulled some numbers out to sort of say, hey, if you insurers paid for medicinal cannabis the way you pay for all other medications, it might actually save you some money because of all these medications that would go down or away. So, you know, again, this is going to be an ongoing thing. And yes, I come from a pharmacy, and yes, if this went through, I would make money on it. So we'll throw that out up front. But,
well, hold on. You might actually lose money, because if you guys were allowed to dispense capsules of THC along with a bottle of Tylenol 3s, where would you be making your money if you're selling less narcotics and less benzos?
Yeah, but do you really... Yes, in theory, that's possible, but do you really think there are less people who are going to come through the doors with, you know, chronic pain, trouble sleeping, migraines, etc.?
It might be
less medications to patient X, but I think there'll be a whole bunch more. Not worried about that at all.
Now, this study tells me that we can go that route. That's where we should be going. Instead of saying, here's your script for Tylenol 3s, get out of here, and maybe I'll give you a second or a third because the pain... Pain doesn't always go away. No. Sometimes you live with pain. You know, getting out of bed at 60 years old, there's a reminder that my knees are 60 years old. But I don't know, Trevor. I think what this study does for me, it reminds me that we have an argument when we talk to doctors that say anybody that pushes cannabis is just a pusher and making money off street drugs that's now legal. I think this tells us that family docs can actually help with the opioid crisis by giving prescriptions of THC CBDs with their acute medicine.
So that segues nicely into Philippe. So, and a reason you have to come back, because somebody's out there is going to say, wow, if you're just taking them off of opioids and putting them on cannabis, aren't we just trading one addiction for another? Philippe answers that. Let's listen to Philippe and then we'll come back.
Today on the line, we have Philippe Lucas from Tilray, and they have done a really interesting study. But Philippe, before I get into the top study, could you tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you got here?
Sure. Thanks for the interest in this work and research. I've been involved in medical cannabis for about 25 years now. I started out as a medical cannabis patient in 1995 when I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. And I found that cannabis was helpful in addressing some of the symptoms and associated with hep C, nausea, lack of appetite, localized pain-related inflammation around my liver. But I was having trouble finding a safe, consistent supply of medical cannabis. So in 1999, I opened up the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, one of Canada's first medical cannabis nonprofit dispensaries, and ran that organization as a nonprofit for about 10 years. And then that's where I started my research and academic career. I went back to university to get a master's, and now I'm just finishing up a PhD, all focused on cannabis research. And my research really focuses on patient patterns of use and the use of medical cannabis as a substitute or an adjunct to the use of prescription drugs, particularly opioids, alcohol, tobacco, and illicit substances. And I've been at Tilray now for about 7 years. I'm the earliest Canadian hire at Tilray, and my job there is I hold a number of files, but I also, along with the clinical research team, oversee our clinical and observational research program.
Thank you. Back when we were allowed to travel, Kirk actually went out to the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club and did some interviews there. So we know the West Coast has a long history of being involved in medical cannabis. I think I missed it. What's your PhD in? What are you studying?
It's in social dimensions of health. It's a program at the University of Victoria. And I also formerly had an affiliation with the Canadian Institute of Substance Use Research out of the University of Victoria as well. And I'm pleased to say I'm going to be defending that PhD in March of this year. So I'm really just in the final days after a good 7.5 years work on that. So it's nice to get this done.
Well, congratulations. Okay, let's get into the top study. So this is a big trial. You guys had brought in over 2,000 people in initially. And then how about sort of walk me through what were you hoping to find and how did you set this up?
Well, the goal of this study was really threefold. We were hoping to learn more about generally how medical cannabis patients across Canada were using medical cannabis. So we gathered a lot of information on patient demographics and cannabis use patterns of use, preferences for example, different methods of ingestion. We also asked patients not just preferences, but what their primary method of ingestion was, preferences and for THC or CBD products and that kind of thing. But we wanted to look at the intersect between those primary patient characteristics and the use of medical cannabis, and then prospectively associated changes in prescription drug use and in quality of life. So for quality of life, we use the World Health Organization quality of life short form, one of the most validated quality of life instruments out there. Right. And for prescription drug use, this was an in-clinic study that took place at 21 clinics, and the physician or healthcare staff actually entered down to the milligrams, the prescription drugs that patients were using at baseline when they started the study, and then again at 1 month, 3 months, and 6 months. So we were able to gather a very granular view of prescription drug use over the 6 month period as and the first 6 months when patients were registered with Tilray, to look at the impact specifically of prescription physician supervised medical cannabis use on a number of different conditions. And it turned out to be the largest national prospective study of medical cannabis patients to date. And we're very grateful to the 2,100 patients and the 21 medical clinics across the country that that participated in the study with us.
Yeah, and it just bears repeating. So you had 1,145 patients actually complete the trial, which is a huge number. And so the other thing that I just found interesting, these were people enrolled prior to October 15th, 2018. Was that because after that it was going to be available recreationally, or just that's just what it happened to be?
That turned out to be the break date for when we decided to do what was initially we were considered it a preliminary data analysis, but it ended up being our penultimate data analysis. And that was a date that from our data pool that would have allowed patients, participants to have the opportunity to be in the study at least 6 months so that we can see if they had actually dropped out or not. We didn't want to cut off anyone that might be filling in, you know, that might be participating beyond that date. But it ended up being a rather auspicious date, as you know, because it ended up, as we all know, being the date of legalization. And in an associated paper, we've now looked at retention in prospective medical cannabis studies like this, and the impact of legalization on retention in studies. And certainly worth noting that legalization did impact retention significantly in this study, and that we saw about a 300% increase in patients that were lost to follow-up post-legalization as patients migrated from the medical system and the recreational system. Of course, it's too early to tell if that's a long-term migration, but certainly Health Canada's data suggests that following legalization, we did see a lot of patients who moved over into the legal system, into the non-medical system. And so I think that that's an issue for our medical cannabis program that'll need to be tackled over the next few years. I think that there are ways to address this migration. I think that cost coverage for medical cannabis would ensure that patients are incentivized to stay in the authorized medical cannabis program and not just self-medicate through the recreational system. And I think that community-based access through pharmacies would add a level of convenience and a level of healthcare oversight in the use of medical cannabis that would really benefit patient outcomes as well.
Yeah, well, preaching to the choir on that one. I obviously biased, but I think medical cannabis should go through pharmacies. I know there's arguments on both sides, but because I've only got you for a short time, I won't go down that rabbit hole. Let's talk a little bit about your patients that came in before we talked about, you know, what happened. So I've got notes here saying things like they were on average married, about 52, more females than not, college educated. So can you talk a little bit about what you found in the people who were enrolled for the study?
Yeah, well, I was very excited as a cannabis researcher to see that there was a slight majority of female participants compared to male participants in the study. As someone who's been involved in cannabis research now for almost 20 years, There was a time when data on medical cannabis was mostly based on men. Men were earlier adopters to medical cannabis use, I think because of its long time, you know, stigma and illicit nature. And so when I started doing surveys of cannabis patients, those surveys used to be about 75% male and 25% female. So it was very exciting that in a few of the prospective studies that Tilray is now involved in, that we're seeing either an equal gender balance or even a slight majority of women who are participating in the program. And I think there's good reasons for that, Trevor. I think that the increase in the number of women in the federal medical cannabis program is due to, well, there's a number of conditions that have a higher prevalence in women, such as fibromyalgia, headaches and migraines, stress, anxiety, depression, lupus, for example, that don't respond very well in a lot of cases to prescription medications, but that do respond very well to medical cannabis. So I think that's one explanation as for why we're seeing more of a gender balance, both in the research that I've been conducting, but also in the federal medical cannabis program as a whole.
Oh, that's great. So let's talk about some of the results, because like you said, since you measured so many things, we got lots of different interesting things out of this. So being a pharmacist, you know, the thing that's jumped out at me first is the number of prescriptions the patients were on at baseline was about 28% of them were on something. And then by the end of it, about 11%. So that's quite a decline.
That's right. We saw a really significant decline in prescription drugs, and there specifically, the data that you're sharing is specific to opioids. So we saw that at baseline, 28% of study participants were taking opioids, and within 6 months that had dropped to 11.3%. So a really significant decline in the actual percentage of patients that were using opioids. And along with that, we saw a significant decline also in the average daily dosage of opioids that patients were using. So that finding was that initially, using what we call the morphine milligram equivalency scale, which you'd be familiar with and with which physicians use often to compare low-grade opioids like codeine to high-grade opioids like OxyContin, for example.
Right.
So using the MME, we found that the average dose at baseline was 152 milligrams of opioids per day, and that at 6 months, that was reduced to 32 milligrams a day. That's a 78% reduction in the actual daily dose of opioids for those that remained on opioids. So really remarkable findings. From an opioid harm perspective, yeah.
Absolutely. And everybody out there by now has heard about the opioid crisis. Maybe many people don't realize that, you know, people like me in white coats contribute to that, because a lot of the opioids people accidentally or less accidentally overdose on actually started at a pharmacy. So if we can reduce the number of prescription opioids out there, that's good for everybody.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. From another publication I did, if I recall, it's something like 75 or 80% of those that end up overdosing on opioids started with a medical prescription for opioids. So there's a really big link with early non-problematic use associated with, say, a medical condition, and then the progression of that use going to non-prescription use. And then, of course, once you start buying opioids in our contaminated illicit market, you have a much higher risk at that point of opioid overdose and potentially death. So I think that if we can reduce our dependence on opioids from a medical perspective, the physicians have more tools in the tool belt to deal with chronic pain, including medical cannabis. You can either stop patients from initially starting down an opioid pathway by prescribing cannabis first, or you can reduce the actual opioids that they're using. So as patients find that they get acclimatized to their opioid dose and they come in to see a physician to increase that dose or the type of opioid they're using in terms of potency, instead of doing that, if you can prescribe cannabis as an adjunct treatment, that might be able to reduce that and prevent that that kind of pathway that could lead to dependence and overdose. And then the other exciting data, unrelated to this study, but certainly from similar groups in BC, the BC CSU, is that there seems to be a link between daily cannabis use and adherence to methadone and suboxone treatment, so opioid agonist therapy. Yeah, and so it seems to be associated with an increased retention, and also other researchers have found lower withdrawal and cravings. And so I think that medical cannabis as an adjunct to methadone suboxone is a very interesting area of research that needs to be considered and moved forward. If it can increase the rate of success of opioid agonist therapy, you can literally save lives.
Okay, and because I can hear someone in the background right now screaming at their phone saying, yeah, but you're just changing one addiction for another. You had another interesting thing in there about the amount of cannabis people were using over the 6 months. Did it go up? Did it go down? Did it stay the same? What did you find?
Yeah, well, thanks for mentioning that. We found something quite remarkable. There's always this concern, understandably, and I answer this question all the time by physicians, about whether or not patients get habituated to the dose of cannabis that they use, and therefore have to, they develop a tolerance and you have to increase the dose over time. That does happen with opioids and with some other medications, but what we found is that there was no statistically significant difference between the baseline dose of cannabis products that patients were using or the dose at 1 month when they'd actually been exposed to cannabis for at least a month's time and the 6 month dose. So there was a slight increase, but it wasn't statistically significant. So based at least on our data within the first 6 months, there didn't seem to be a tolerance to the therapeutic effects of cannabis, but what we often hear from patients is they develop a tolerance to some of the side effects of cannabis-based medicines, the red eyes, dry mouth, and in some cases, even the impairment associated with THC. So this was a good news finding for those who were worried that that, as you suggest, you're just replacing one drug with another. And just to add one more point to that, you know, we're always as a society, I think we now understand that that the goal of harm reduction is not always abstinence based. It can be about reducing the harms associated with substance use. And when it comes to medical cannabis, the harms, you know, the harm benefit ratio of medical cannabis compared to opioids favors medical cannabis significantly in terms of the overall safety profile. There is zero risk of actual overdose and death, right. A much lower risk of dependence forming, and overall far fewer side effects associated with medical cannabis than opioids. So if patients can successfully treat chronic pain and other conditions using medical cannabis rather than opioids, or even let's say benzodiazepines, and non-opioid pain medications, there could be some significant benefits in there, you know, via harm reduction perspective.
And because I know I'm running short on time, but you actually segues nicely into, so you didn't just look at opioids. You looked at non-opioid pain meds, antidepressants, anti-seizure meds, and benzodiazepines in sort of the list of things you were looking at. So what happened to the amounts of those that the people were taking?
Well, we used a formula devised by the World Health Organization called Defined Daily Dose that allows you to compare different antidepressants and different benzodiazepines or anti-seizure medications with different pharmacokinetic effects, but allows a cross comparison of those. And so looking at defined daily dose in the five other classes of drugs, primary classes of drugs mentioned by patients other than opioids, which are non-opioid pain medications, antidepressants, anti-seizure drugs, benzodiazepines, as well as sleep aids and muscle relaxants, we saw statistically significant reductions in the defined daily dose of all of those drugs as well. And so while we have a very visible public opioid overdose crisis, a lot of Canadians don't realize we also have a very deadly benzodiazepine crisis in Canada as well. The combination of benzodiazepines that are highly dependent with alcohol often leads to significant morbidity and mortality. So if you can reduce the dependence on benzodiazepines and some of these other non-opioid pain medications, you get a significant net public health benefit. But I also want to add that We also looked at the medication costs associated with all this prescription drug use.
Good. I want to ask about that part. Yes.
Yeah, good, good. And we saw that at baseline, all this prescription drug use equated to about $106 per month worth of prescription drug spending on average by patients. And that at 6 months was reduced to $18 per month. That's an 87% reduction in prescription drug use costs overall, excluding the cost of cannabis.
Right.
And so really significant. And as someone who's been advocating for cost coverage of medical cannabis by private payers, and ultimately, I believe this should be covered by public insurance or provincial insurance coverage. This goes a long way to making that argument that you reduce prescription drug use costs when patients use medical cannabis.
I love this study, and there's so much more, but I know we only have you for a limited time, so maybe I'll just go to this. Was there anything you wished I'd asked or anything else you wish our listeners knew about the TOP study or anything else about sort of what you found about people who use medical cannabis across Canada, since this was such a large and detailed survey?
Trevor, I've really enjoyed this discussion. I think the only thing that I'd mention is at the same time as we saw the significant reductions in opioid and prescription drug use, we also saw statistically significant improvements in all four domains of quality of life. And we saw the greatest changes in physical health, where we saw a 30% increase in quality of life, and in psychological health, where we saw a 17% increase in the overall psychological health of these patients. So really exciting. And I think that, you know, from that data, if I had to summarize the findings of the Tilray observational patient study, is you've got a group of patients who are largely affected by chronic pain and mental health conditions. You introduce medical cannabis in their course of care, and then you get an associated reductions in the use of prescription drugs, including prescription opioids, and statistically significant improvements in quality of life. So really exciting to see this finding, and certainly supportive of what patients have been sharing with us for so long. But nice to have this significant data set to point to those outcomes as well now.
Oh yeah, having numbers to back up what patients and clinicians have been saying for years is fantastic. Philippe, this was a great chat. I really enjoyed it. And I know our listeners are really going to enjoy this interview as well. Thank you very much for your time.
Trevor, thank you very much for the interest, and thanks to your viewers as well. We've got some other really exciting findings just coming out over the next few weeks. So I really hope we have a chance to do this again. Have a great day, Trevor.
So Trevor, so that's your, this is your second episode on the opioid, and you said you might have a third coming?
Yeah, maybe. There are some guidelines, Canadian guidelines, that are coming out now. They're talking about how you could get somebody off of, get a patient off of or reduce their opioids with cannabinoids. So I'm chatting with the gentleman about that one, so hopefully that turns into it. But let's talk about Philippe. So the question I posed just before we went into the interview, so do you remember what Philippe said about, so what happens if we just sort of take somebody off of an opioid and put them on a cannabinoid? You know, aren't we trading one addiction for another? Do you remember his answer?
I'll let you go for it.
So he said that, of course, they looked at that, and a big part of their study is they found, you know, when they put somebody on medicinal cannabis, you know, at X level, what you don't want to see is the amount of cannabis they use sort increase and increase over time, because, you know, that might be the beginning of an addiction, a problem or whatever. That's not what they saw. It was relatively flat, and sometimes even flat slash going down. So putting somebody onto a cannabinoid didn't seem to be putting them on something that they wanted more and more of. Now, again, it was only 6 months, and there's going to be, but it's just, it, you know, at least over the 6 months, it wasn't like we started them here and their dose just took off.
Right. They didn't substitute. I mean, one of the problems with opioids is that you get the pain from the drug. So if, you know, if I'm on opioids chronically and I'm taking it every day, eventually you're creeping. And with cannabis, the thought is, well, people get tolerance. You know, I smoke so much of it, I'm not getting high. Well, yeah, but they didn't see that. The other thing about cannabis is that once the acute nature of the pain is done, and you should be weaning yourself off the Tylenol 3s or whatever it is you're using, you also can take a break from cannabis, and we learned that from Sue. When she takes a break from cannabis and with her Lyme's disease, you know, a week or 2 weeks break, she comes back and she can use less cannabis and get a response. So they found, I guess they found that way that it doesn't happen. She found it anecdotally. She found taking a break helped her use less cannabis. So could be also the individual.
But, yeah, and obviously it's more to learn, and their study was only 6 months long, and yeah. But still, yeah. Just I know I said a bunch at the beginning, worth repeating. This was big. Like, there was lots of people in lots of places. That, so, you know, cannabis studies, they're just, you know, 20 stoners in, you know, Vancouver who, you know, they looked at. No, across Canada, over 1,400 patients. This was a big prospective study. So this is really good to add to the evidence.
Another thing that I think can happen with this study is governments can look at it, because governments right now are also, I mean, the PharmaCare, is PharmaCare in Manitoba?
In Manitoba, it's called PharmaCare, okay. Where the government helps pay for your medication.
Yeah, so people that are on chronic analgesics, are those pills covered in PharmaCare?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So one thing this study taught us is that people that substitute or use cannabis in conjunction with their opioids is that their costs have gone down.
Yes.
So governments, again, governments could save money by putting cannabis into pharmacies and allowing family doctors and pharmacists to augment its use with pain.
If there was coverage, but yeah, and maybe another episode for another day, but yeah, that is a current issue with patients. And so, you know, let's say I was on $200 a month worth of morphine, but you know, it's paid for by my provincial program. Even if it, you know, would only take me $100 worth of cannabis a month to have the same effect, you know, from my pocket's point of view, I go from paying nothing to paying $100 a month.
Yeah.
So, not having any sort of coverage on medicinal cannabis, I don't think is good for patients.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I do not have any family doctor prescribed medication. So the times that I have come to your pharmacy and I submit my prescription and you tell me there's no fee. And what do you mean there's no fee? That must be PharmaCare covering it.
No, you wouldn't ever go. You don't buy it. Okay, so in Manitoba, you don't buy enough drugs. You don't buy enough drugs. So, and a lot of the provincial programs are like this. So there's the deductible. So, you know, in Manitoba, it starts April 1st. You start buying your drugs. And if you bought, so let's say your deductible is $1,000 for a year. You buy your drugs until you get to $1,000. And then after $1,000, the Manitoba Health pays for your medications until the next March 31st. And then you start paying again. Different provinces have different systems, but that's kind of sort of how most provincial systems work. And insurance companies work kind of sort of, some of them work on a deductible system too. But yeah, if you know, you spend the majority of your year not paying for your, you know, your opioid prescriptions, and even if you find that the cannabis ones work better, or they're safer or whatever, it's going to be hard pressed for you to say, but you know, I don't want the government to pay I'd rather pay out of pocket completely, because you know, cannabis doesn't go through the same system. But anyway,
yeah, okay.
Maybe,
but there's potential.
And it was nice though that the Tilray study did show on a large grand scale, the government could actually look at this and go, you know, we used to spend X amount on prescription drugs. If we instead paid for the cannabis, we might actually save money. And I think that's a good, thing to wrap up on.
Yeah, I haven't read the study yet, but does it talk about any biases in the study? Because you are correct. He is a vice president of a medical cannabis shop. So how did he get around the biases component?
So some of the strengths that, you know, they got samples from 21 different medical clinics across 5 Canadian provinces. It might not be representative of the whole Canada, but, you know, I don't think that's terrible. As many of the clinics specialize in treating chronic pain, you know, they might have overrepresented pain patients in their group.
But then the whole study's on pain. So being overrepresented is.
Yeah, but if we were trying to sort of represent sort of Canadian cannabis users in general, we have.
Right. Okay.
They could have used cannabis other than that provided by Tilray, and they were patients were compensated by Tilray. So there's a possibility that of a retention bias, i.e. they liked the fact that they got paid something, so that's why they came back and could have possibly said sort of nice things about them when they otherwise might not have. And, you know, a lot, if not all of the money to run the study came from Tilray, so, you know, that does throw some biases in. But, you know, I don't think those are terrible
still
limitations to have.
It's still a large study. It still advocates that cannabis has a role to play in the opioids, in the opioid crisis we're feeling. So, yeah, well on. Well done. So, you got an idea of music for this one?
I do not. All right, we'll leave this one for Renee. So, as usual, I'm Trevor Shufeldt. I'm the pharmacist. Who are you?
I'm Kirk Nyquist. I'm the Reefer Medicine's the podcast. Check out our new webpage, reefermed.ca.
All right, Kirk, that was fun. I hope everyone enjoyed that as much as I did, and we'll talk to everybody later.
Cheers.
All right, it's Renee back here at the studio, and another great show, guys. Thank you very much. And, of course, I have a song that we can end off the episode with, and it happens to be pretty local to Dauphin as well. 45 minutes north of here is Winnipegosis, and in Winnipegosis is a lady named Emma Peterson, who had a song out last year called Maybe Tonight. Very cool tune. Well, she just came out with another one. It's called Hurt Like Hell, and that's the song for today. Cheers.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Talk to you later.
You always had warm hands, a cold heart. When I heal, there's gonna be a scar. 'Cause I loved and I trusted you for the last time, that's right. Hurt like hell.
So, you got an idea of music for this one?
I do not.
Wow, you got to start coming. You got to start coming with music in your hand.
I'm a little
dude.
More prepared. Do you have an idea, or should we throw this one to Renee?
No, I don't have any either. No.